for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live, coast to coast, on radio stations from California and Oregon to West Virginia and North Carolina, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, wayrosesociety.org, Live 365's American FM, and in 29 states on digital cable systems on CRN Digital. Welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us today. It's Friday. The first hour of our regular Friday program is always our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. And Congressman Sanders, seven times reelected as for the longest serving independent in the history of the House of Representatives. And his website, bernie.house.gov. If you want more information, Bernie always has some great stories, articles, news things, what he's doing, what's up there. And Bernie, something flew by me the other day that said something like Bernie.com. Do you have a website like that, too?
We have a campaign website. That's political as opposed to congressional, which is www.bernie.org.
Bernie.org, okay.
Yeah, that's political, but the congressional one is Bernie.house.gov.
Okay, so for business, Bernie.house.gov.
Right.
Great. Okay, and Bernie, welcome to the program. Thanks so
much.
For
good to be with you, Tom.
Yeah, it's always I so appreciate every week, and I know our listeners do, too.
It's mutual. You know, I'm going to be going to a media conference in St. Louis, actually leaving tonight and being part of a panel and giving a speech there tomorrow. I mean, one of the points that I'll be making is that folks like you and a handful of other progressive voices are playing an enormously important role in allowing millions of Americans to hear about issues that they otherwise would not hear. So you keep up the very good work that you're doing.
Great. Yeah, thank you. And a plug for the show there would be appreciated. Let them know about us. It's a conference that I had really debated going to, but you know, with this move out here to Oregon and so all this stuff going on, I just couldn't make it. But that the media really is an issue that is the issue under which every other issue has to, or on top of which, let's say, every other issue has to sit, because the media is now our town square. It's now our community. It's now the way that we know what's going on amongst each other.
Or don't know what's going on. And that is exactly right. And that's why I know, you know, many of your listeners are concerned about the economy. They're concerned about the war and foreign policy. They're concerned about the environment and a dozen other issues. But as you just said, no matter what you are concerned about, you must be concerned about the media, because if the American people can't really learn about what's going on in their lives, in their states, in their country, how are they going to come up with a reasonable analysis and solutions to the problems that we face? And to my mind, I mean, when you're talking about fewer and fewer large media conglomerates, whether it's General Electric or Disney or Viacom or News Corp, owning more and more of our media, we see more and more mergers, and we see the Bush administration trying to deregulate. That's a movement in exactly the wrong direction. What we need is more diversity. We need to use the new technologies that are out there to allow people to hear more points of view, and so they can formulate their own judgments. But I worry very much that people simply don't know that when you turn on General Electric's a TV network, you're hearing General Electric's point of view, and they have enormous conflicts of interest, and that's true of virtually all of the media conglomerates.
Yeah, we need more stations like WDEV, for example, our affiliate in Vermont, that locally family-owned for two generations now, and doing incredible radio. I mean, was it Harper's did or The Atlantic did a profile of them? I mean, just incredible radio.
Yeah, they are part of the community.
Yeah, very much so.
I often mention them. When I was mayor of the city of Burlington, Vermont, we had a number of radio stations who covered what City Hall was doing, what the school board was doing what WDEV in Waterbury does. But increasingly, that's becoming rare. People don't know what's going on in their local communities. And that's not a good thing for democracy or a good thing for America. So this whole issue of media is something we have to focus on. The whole telecommunications bill is up for reauthorization. It was last passed in 1996, and I voted against it for a number of reasons, not the least of which it deregulated radio, which I think was a very bad thing. It also allowed cable companies to be deregulated, which meant that they could charge whatever rates they wanted to charge. The result of that has been the cable TV rates have soared. But it's going to come up for reauthorization. It will give the American people a real opportunity to get involved in what the future of telecommunications in America will be. And I would hope that members of Congress and the FCC will be holding town meetings all over this country to getting input from people. There's a radical new changes in technology. How do we democratize media in America so more points of view are heard, diversity is heard, localism is important? And that's an issue I hope that our listeners and the American people will be involved in.
Yeah, and to some extent, you know, the market, as much as I like to say, you know, Franklin Roosevelt saved American democracy from unregulated capitalism. But nonetheless, the marketplace is in some ways pushing this. A lot of stations, a lot of big corporate-owned stations now are starting to go back to local programming. I mean, that's what I'm doing here in Portland on a Clear Channel station.
Because they're seeing that there's a market there.
That's
people
right.
want to hear it.
They
that's
can
right.
make money at it.
That's
and,
right.
And so, you know, that's a good sign.
Right.
But, you know, it's a shame that it's taken so long. And well, in any case, I think that's a good
sign. And the other part of that, I think it's a point that you've made in the past, is that not so many years ago, talk radio was almost all extreme right-wing. Mm. And what we're seeing now in a nation that is politically divided is some local stations are catching on to the fact that not everybody in their listening area is, you know, wants to hear Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah.
And that people want to hear different points of view, and progressive voices like yourselves are beginning to be heard more and more around the country.
Well, and in fact, what's happening is that people around the country are realizing that progressive voices like this program and the programs on Air America and on Jones Network really reflect the interests of the middle class, the rapidly vanishing middle class that you so often talk about.
Yeah, and that is an issue that we have got to hop away at and keep talking about. I'll tell you why. What concerns me about corporate control over the media is not just the obvious corporate bias that exists. That's very important. But more important are the issues that are not being discussed. And if you do not hear issues that are very important to your life on the television, on the radio, you begin to wonder whether, in fact, these are issues that impact anybody else in America. If you're a working mother listening to this program right now who is having a very hard time finding affordable child care for your kid, you may say, well, gee, I must be the only person in America. My community must be the only community in America that doesn't have good quality and affordable child care. Wrong. It takes place all over America, but we're not talking about it. More importantly is, you know, what you talk about and I talk about is what we call the collapse of the middle class. You know, many workers today, despite an explosion of technology and worker productivity, are working longer hours for lower wages. The real inflation accounted for income of workers is declining. Poverty is increasing. How often do we talk about it as a nation? I'll tell you a funny story, Tom. I did a meeting on Monday night, just this last Monday night, a town meeting in Springfield, Vermont, which is a pretty small town in southern Vermont, maybe 3,000 or 4,000 people. We had 250 people out to this meeting to talk about poverty. Now, how often are we talking about poverty in America? Not very often. But what I found at that meeting is that people understand that poverty is a huge issue, it's a growing issue, and they want discussion about it. What are the causes of poverty? Why do we have by far the highest childhood rate of poverty in the industrialized world? Why is the situation getting worse? What role can government play to alleviate and eliminate poverty? How often do we hear discussion about poverty in the corporate media?
How often do we even hear the history of this, Bernie? LBJ's programs in 3 years cut poverty in half in the United States. From 1945 to 1975, that 30-year period, during that 30-year period when there was heavy government regulation of business and the average CEO only earned 30 times what the average worker owned, the average income of the average worker in America doubled. From 1980, when Reagan came into office, to today, the average income of the average worker in America has declined by 11%.
That simple fact should be something that is being discussed all over America, should be on the front pages of the paper, and people may have differences of opinion as to the how and the why, but you're right. How often is that important fact being discussed? Today in the United States, over 20% of our children live in poverty, the highest rate in the industrialized world, and we have people on TV talking about family values. And, gee, just how much we love our children. We do less for our kids than do the governments of any other industrialized country on earth. But how often do we talk about
it? And this is a moral issue.
this is surely a moral issue.
I mean, they want to say the only moral issue out there is whether gays can have can be married or you know, whatever. And that's not the only moral issue we're facing.
No, it surely is not. That, and that's the point. They define what the moral issues are. When you have children in America living in poverty, in some cases not getting enough food to eat, in extreme cases, sleeping out on the street, if that's not a moral issue, then you tell me what a moral issue is. When you have 45 million Americans who have no health insurance, when people get sick and die because they can't get to a doctor, if that's not a moral issue, what is a moral issue? And that's the problem with what goes on in media. Those folks have access to determine what they consider to be the moral issue. Our side does not have that megaphone. And that's why the media is so terribly important and why everyone in America should be involved in that debate.
Although occasionally stories crack through. For example, the United Airlines employees who are saying, hey, wait a minute, we're being screwed here, is starting to make it into the media.
Well, this is a huge issue. It was a good front page story. And I don't mean to suggest, and I know you don't, Tom, that, you know, we live in some kind of country where, you know, the stories do not get out. Of course, there's a lot of good media, and we hear a whole lot. The New York Times, just the other day, front page story on United being now able to rescind the pensions that they had promised their workers. And it will mean, as the government pension organization pays it out, that many United workers will be losing 25 or 50% of what they had been promised. And there is no reason to doubt that other airlines may well do the same thing. And that,
well, US Air already did, didn't they, a couple of years ago?
Yeah, that's right, exactly. That's right. And it sets in motion the automobile industry. You know, Ford, GM having financial problems. Will they now be demanding that the unions agree to cutbacks in the pensions that have been promised to their workers? And on it goes. And this is a huge, huge issue, because what we're seeing is all over this country, companies now telling workers, yeah, we did promise you something, but, you know, we're not going to give it to you. We're going to cut back. And I've been involved in that issue big time, here in Congress, leading the opposition to that effort with some success. But it is, then that takes you right to the whole Social Security issue, which remains today, the only guarantee that the elderly people and retirees have, that in fact they will be getting their monthly check, which is why we absolutely have got to oppose Bush's effort to privatize Social Security. But this is a huge issue, and there's a lot of anxiety out there among workers who are wondering whether the pensions promised to them will actually be there.
Yeah, and pensions, and now they're worrying about whether Social Security will actually be there.
That's right.
If Bush gets his hands on it. 20 minutes past the hour, it's the Tom Hartman radio program, Brunch with Bernie, our weekly session with Congressman Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, soon to be Senator Sanders, in my opinion. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number if you'd like to be on with Bernie. Give us a shout. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 25 minutes past the hour. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number. We're with Congressman Bernie Sanders here. Florian in Arlington Heights, Illinois on the line. Hey, Florian, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you. A few questions for Bernie, or two questions. He was just talking about the United problem. Is there any way to legislatively change the priorities? United has succeeded in dumping pension plans, and now they're fighting with leasers as to whether some of their aircraft can be taken back. Shouldn't pension plans be put ahead of any and all unsecured creditors, and is that feasible to do that?
Shouldn't they be in a lockbox, as it were?
Yeah. That is exactly, Florin, an issue that we're looking very hard at right now. I think this United business has put a red flag on the many members of Congress to take a hard look at what's going on with pensions. The transparency, which in fact exists, I think there are a lot of workers appropriately enough worried now. Is there, in fact, enough money in their company's fund to provide the benefits that have been promised? But I think your point is a good point. Promises were made to workers, and I think that should be very close to the top of the list in terms of what the company pays out.
Okay. Second question is, I just found out that a H.R. 676, a National Health Care Insurance Act, sponsored by Connors, Kucinich.
John Conyers, yeah.
Okay. I assume you're familiar with the bill, Bernie.
Yeah.
Is that something that you were looking at?
Yeah, it's something that we're looking at. My preference is, what I believe in, Florin, is a single-payer system administered at the state wide at the state level rather than at the federal level. But John is doing a very, very good job in raising the issue of a single-payer system. My slight difference with him is I want to see it administered state by state, where I think the people can have more ability to alter it and participate in the process. But the idea of single-payer moving away from the disintegrating system that we have right now is the direction to go.
Okay. Is there any way for that to get any public notice or traction?
Well, I just talked to John the other day. In fact, he's, I think, probably in New York this weekend talking to a bunch of folks about it.
To the public. Okay.
Yeah. Is he ever going to get on CBS or on Face the Nation or something?
Well,
like
I suspect probably not. What I can tell you is back when Clinton was president, when healthcare was very high on the agenda, the piece of legislation that had most support in the Congress was single-payer, which I support. It was amazing how little discussion that particular approach got. The companies obviously don't want to hear about it, nor do the drug companies. So it's hard to get that issue out. In the state of Vermont, for example, we are doing better, I think, than most states, and our state, the House of Representatives, has pushed forward a pretty good piece of legislation.
Great. Dava in Berryville, Arkansas. We have about a minute and a half here, Dava.
Okay. I feel like I know y'all, Mr. Hartman and Congressman Sanders, but from listening to you on the Friday.
Well, nice to meet you, Dava.
Yes.
What I'd like to do was to mention this managed pensions that have been managed off the map by the way that people that work in the medical profession and have had to be paid through companies that work through Medicare, Medicaid, and the refusal to pay by our national government to Medicare, Medicaid companies. And there's been a rollover over the last 15 years. Every two or three years, those companies have been had to go belly up because the funding wouldn't come in, refusal to pay because periods weren't put down or a wrong number was missed or having nothing to do with the service not being rendered.
This is from Medicare and Medicaid.
For people that work under Medicare, Medicaid,
right.
Like occupational therapists, PTs,
right.
Nurses, and people that run the companies that book those people to different hospitals and whatnot. This is a huge problem.
So Bernie will have to wrap up responding.
Well, Dava, I am familiar with that problem, and she is absolutely right. And I think you're dealing with an administration that is not particularly sympathetic to Medicare or Medicaid, adequately funding either program.
Yeah, okay. Dava, thank you very much for the call. Good to hear from you, and thanks for that answer, Bernie. 29 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Brunch with Bernie, 1-866-889-8894.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number if you'd like to speak with Congressman Bernie Sanders or me. Although this is the Brunch with Bernie segment, this is mostly your questions for Bernie Sanders. 27 minutes before the hour. Kevin in Philadelphia on the line. Hey, Kevin.
Guys, how you doing?
Good.
Congressman Sanders, I want to let you know I do support your... your opposition to controlling satellite and cable, the FCC getting involved with satellite and cable.
Thank you, Kevin. That's a very important issue.
Yeah, I heard that on another station, a guy who's actually going to be coming to Sirius Satellite. But anyway, Congressman, you were talking earlier about you're against the conglomeration of corporations buying up all the TV and radio stations.
Yes, that's correct.
Are you missing the elephant that's sitting in the room with you here? Tom works for Clear Channel.
And Bernie's on Clear Channel, on four Clear Channel stations right now.
Right. I mean, is that hypocrisy, or what are we talking about here?
Kevin, isn't it really using the tools to get the things done that you need to get done?
Well, if you accept.
I mean, what kind of car are you driving, Kevin?
I drive it. Listen, I'm a righty from way back. I drive an Infiniti. I'm actually sitting here getting a tail right now.
But Kevin, the point is the media.
It's hypocritical of you guys to sit here and blather on and on and on and on about it. You know, the man. And later today, Tom's going to get a paycheck from the man. So
I don't think that that's hypocritical at all. The fact that you want to go out and talk to people and use the resources that are there is exactly what we should be doing.
You use the tools that will get you out. It's
right.
And beyond that, as much as I am personally opposed to media accumulation, I think that it is not, and this is the point that I make about Walmart, for example. It's not that corporations are inherently evil. It is that the rules of the game need to be changed. I mean, we had different rules of the game 20 years ago than we have now, and I think that these rules need to be changed. But to say, oh, gee, I'm not going to take an opportunity to go to a major city in the United States and speak to hundreds of thousands of people every day and promote a progressive message because it's owned by Clear Channel, that seems to me insane. You know, to pass up an opportunity like that to spread the message. I mean, you know, but as Kevin's pointed out, he's a righty. He's just trying to.
Well, he raises an issue, but I think he is dead wrong on it.
Yeah, there you go. Let's go back to Pennsylvania to John in Pennsylvania. Hey, John, what's up?
Gentlemen, how you doing?
Good.
Yeah, Bernie, I saw you on Bill Maher. Same issue. I strongly support that, too. I think that's very, very important. The other thing that they were discussing on Bill Maher, Bill Maher was saying how, and this is something that goes back to this whole media question, how conservatives seem to have an open ticket to say the most outrageous things while the opposition cannot. Legislation, I guess, really can't do anything for that in particular, but what kind of sympathy is there in Congress to do something to really stop the media from staying on this path of ignoring issues the way that you were discussing before?
I think what that gets back is making sure that there are there's a great deal of diversity in media, so that different ideas can be spread. I don't think it's the function of the government to tell CBS or NBC what to do. What the function of the government is to make sure that there are all kinds of opportunities for all kinds of Americans to express their point of view so that we can have a real debate over ideas. I think the point that you initially made is that you hear people like Pat Robertson say the most outrageous things. I mean, I think he was suggesting that judges do more harm or a greater threat to America, for example, than our terrorists. Then was Hitler. I mean, there you go. And this is an important political leader within the Republican Party, a serious candidate for president of the United States some years ago. And will anybody rebuke him? Will the Republicans say, gee, you know, we can't work with you because you're saying something so outrageous? Not at all. It will be said and then passed over. That gets back to the issue of who owns the media and what kinds of points of view are getting out to the American people.
Bernie, you heard what Pat Buchanan said over the weekend?
Nope.
He said, why are we elevating FDR and Churchill, and why did we attack Hitler? He said there was no, these guys, the American president and the British prime minister should not be elevated, that in fact Hitler was elected by his people, and therefore the Germans did not need to be liberated. I'm quoting Pat Buchanan. The Germans did not need to be liberated because Hitler was elected by his people, and that France had been provoking him.
Wow. Did he really say that?
Honest to God. Yep. The media matters had a whole
piece. That is on a number of TV stations as a commentator, right?
Yeah, for sure. And he's a former Republican candidate for president of the United States. It's outrageous. Scott in San Diego on the line. Hey, Scott.
Well, good morning, gentlemen. I think this past weekend, Pat Robertson slipped the bounds of his medications and was truly. Anyway, Tom, I got a quick question for you and Bernie, you too. Tom, I was listening yesterday, and you had talked about a map of Iraq, a document that was released March 5th, 2001. You said 35AS0713. I have searched everywhere on the web. I can't find it.
Go to, as much as it pains me to say this, go to judicialwatch.org, the website of this right-wing group that started the lawsuit against Bill Clinton. They're also the ones who sued Dick Cheney. And on judicialwatch.org, you can find those maps.
Thank you.
They have the PDFs of them, the actual documents that were released. So,
great. I'll find it because this is so shocking. Bernie, what does it look like in Congress right now? We got Bob Filner down here in San Diego.
Who's, by the way, doing an excellent job.
He's a great man, but we're kind of curious down here. He didn't show up, you know, for a talk about this memo that was released through 10 Downing Street and MI6 on the 1st of May. It's virtually not made it here. Murdoch owns the London Times, and he also owns Fox News. It's not a big story in Fox News. So I'm wondering what's going on within Congress about this memo. This thing shocks me.
It was a screaming headline in the London Times, which is why you point that out.
Well, I can't say that it has shocked too many people in Congress. I mean, the debate here in Congress right now, to the degree that there is a debate, is how much longer should the taxpayers of this country be providing tens and tens of billions of dollars for this war? How much longer should we see our troops getting killed? And when do we begin to say, as George Aiken said, you know, George Aiken said during the Vietnam War, declare victory and let's start getting out. I opposed the war from the beginning, helped lead the opposition to it. We're in there now. I don't think you can leave tomorrow. But I think that the President of the United States is obligated now, after the deaths of 1,600 American soldiers and 12,000 wounded, to say, okay, you know, they have a government in Iraq now. We're going to support that government. We're going to support their military. But it is time to begin bringing home our troops.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for the call. Bill in Cleveland on the line. Hey, Bill.
Hi. How you doing, Tom?
Great.
Hey, Bernie, I'll try to make it quick because I know Tom is limited time-wise with you. But my representative here in Cleveland is Stephanie Tubbs-Jones, who we really love here.
Yep.
And she, along with Barbara Boxer and Hillary Clinton, have a bill that they've drawn up. I downloaded it. It's about, it's fairly long, but it's called the Count Every Vote Act. And, you know, it's election reform.
Yes.
And my question is, what do we as citizens need to do to bring this bill, you know, to help bring this bill into conference and hopefully bring it to the floor?
Well, this is a huge issue, and I know that Tom and I have discussed it. I'm sure Tom has spent a lot of time on it. And there is a great concern in America, especially as a result of the last two national elections, about touchscreen balloting, about secretaries of states who do not do a good job in making sure that everybody has the right to vote promptly. So this is a huge issue, because if we cannot trust the fact about our right to vote and making sure that our ballots are going to be counted, then what is democracy? So I would suggest, as I often do, that I think what people have got to do is start holding town meetings. You know, call up your member of Congress and say, this is an issue that we are concerned about. We are going to have 50 or 100 people at the local church or the local school. We want you to come down and talk to us about what role you're going to play to make sure that every vote in America that's cast is in fact counted, that we're going to increase our voter turnout, that we're not going to have long waiting lines which discourage people from voting, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what my suggestion is. Call up your member of Congress. People don't do that enough.
Like I said, Stephanie Tubbs-Jones is my representative, and she is a co-sponsor.
No, Stephanie is great, but I'm suggesting that other people should start calling up their members of Congress.
Right, and I even wrote Senator Voinovich about this and received a letter in response saying that, well, we passed the HAVA Act of 2002, and, you know, in so many words, he was basically telling me
Isn't that enough? That
was good enough.
But your job is to tell them it's not enough and to, you know, put the democratic pressure on elected officials that it should be happening out of democracy.
Just biting at their heels?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Bill, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Frank in Phoenix on the line. Hey, Frank.
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Hi, Bernie.
Hi.
My question as a frustrated progressive, when are the Dems going to you know, fight back like the Republicans do. When Reid said call Bush a loser, I don't want to hear him say I'm sorry for doing that. I want him to, you know, fight back at these people. They're not our friends. Bill Frist isn't standing there saying my compadre, my friend, or anything. They're treating us Democrats like dogs, and I'm tired of it. You know, mm-hmm. I want Dems to fight back. Look at what happened to Kerry last year. He didn't fight back against the boat people or whatever mm-hmm. you want to call them. Mm-hmm. And look what happened to him. I'm tired of Dems just standing there.
I think, you know, Frank, I think you're right. And I think that this Republican majority is essentially owned and controlled by corporate interests. Their main job in life is making billionaires even richer. And it is imperative that Democrats and progressives around this country lay out proposals which represent the interest of the collapsing middle class, of lower-income people, of the elderly, of the sick. And if we lay that out, and if we fight for it, and if we go back into our districts and we organize around it, we can turn this country around. But ultimately, we have got to go back to working people, the ordinary people who are struggling today. And if we do that, we turn this country around, and we stand up, and we fight for what we believe in.
Well said. Thanks a lot for the call from Phoenix. John in Dallas on the line. Hey, John.
Hello. I want to expand a little bit on what Bill was saying just a little while ago about the voting reform.
Yep.
And I hear what you say also about calling our representatives and senators. My problem is that my two senators are Mr. Cornyn and Mrs. Hutchinson, and my representative is Pete Sessions, and Pete Sessions is way on the other side of where I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So but, I don't know if you know Mr. Sessions.
I do. But,
okay.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. You go.
Okay. But I was going to say is that my understanding of even the HAVA Act says that we are supposed to have paper ballots, and we don't in violation of that, and who's holding accountable for it? I understand that there is an election commission that is just really neutered. They really don't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Which is new. No, I wouldn't say that they're neutered. The problem is that the HAVA Act does not go far enough, as we saw in the last election. But getting back to the first point that you made about who your congressmen and your senators are,
mm-hmm.
that doesn't preclude you or others in Texas or any place else in America from holding meetings, from getting the folks interested in the issue, from getting media attention to the issue and putting pressure on your elected officials. I'll give you an example of something which really was quite interesting. We have a major crisis in affordable housing in America.
Mm-hmm.
There is a group called the Low Income Housing Coalition that went, I think, into every congressional office in America. The end result is we had several hundred co-sponsors on very good legislation. So don't give up just because you have a conservative member of Congress. You can hold meetings. You can put pressure on that member, and you would be surprised sometimes at the results.
Good. Thanks a lot, John, for the call. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. Lori in Colorado on the line. Hey, Lori.
Hello, gentlemen. Thanks so much for this venue.
Hi, Lori.
Hi. I have a question for Congressman Sanders. My fear is that the people in the United States will never get to vote from an informed position due to the media problem that we have here. And I just think everyone will keep on picking the wrong candidates as long as they are not informed because the news is not accurate. And I wanted to ask the congressman if he has heard anything about the possibility of a centrist or more to the left commercial news network for television, because I feel that would be the best thing that could happen to this country, because I just feel, you know, I'm really afraid that change can't happen as long as people are in the dark about what's actually happening, and it will cause them to pick the wrong candidates over and over.
Well, Lori, I think you make a very good point. There has been discussion on and off over the years. The problem is that if you wanted to buy a major network today like ABC or CBS, Tom, what do those things go for now? How many billions?
It would be dozens to hundreds. I don't know. I know Ted Turner had talked about wanting to put together some folks to buy back CNN, and he took one look at it, and it was way beyond his means, and he's a billionaire.
Yeah, so that's the immediate problem. But there are people, I think, you know, people like former Vice President Gore who are talking about or moving in certain directions, this stuff on radio. So the answer is it is a good idea. I'm not sure that people on our side immediately have the money to buy a major network.
I wonder if maybe you could keep your eyes and ears tuned at this media conference in St. Louis and see if anything comes up about that.
Okay, I sure will.
I would say the gradual approach, by the way, seems to be working in radio. I mean, what we're seeing now is that, for example, Clear Channel is the largest distributor of progressive programming in America, and just because they can make money at it. And I think when the TV industry starts waking up to the fact that there are people who want to hear this, that you're going to start seeing progressive television as well. And that then may open a door for a TV equivalent of Air America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's a possibility. So, you know, step by step. And in the meantime, wouldn't it be nice if there was a Rupert Murdoch out there on the left? But, you know, somebody needs to talk to George Soros. Anyway, we're talking with Bernie Sanders, Congressman Bernie Sanders. Brunch with Bernie, 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-889-8894. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
We're privatizing Medicare, it's history, and what will take its place will be a prime example, truly ample, opportunity.
Oh, it's the billionaires for Bush. Welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you with Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment for the day. John in Riverside, California on the line. Hey, John.
Well, good morning or good afternoon, Tom and Representative Sanders.
Thank you.
The reason why I'm calling is, number one, on the media thing, I remember back in the 80s when the Reagan administration changed the FCC rules requiring that the actual news become a for-profit rated enterprise for the networks as opposed to
allowing it, yeah.
Yeah. And wouldn't repealing that regulation go a long way towards turning the media back into the public servant it's supposed to be?
Well, I think in terms of the major on-air television stations, what we have got to get back to is that the public is giving them these airwaves. And it has got to be used not just to make zillions of dollars in profit, but used as a public service, which means good education, good entertainment, and not just programming designed to make huge amounts of money. That's the real issue that we've got to focus on.
Lee in Houston on the line. Hey, Lee.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Good. What's up?
Hey, I got a quick question for Bernie. I see how the legislation gets passed on Sunday. I read it in the paper. I just had a quick question about the last energy bill, and something that went with it was that was voted down was to have cars go 33 miles a gallon by the year 2015. That was voted against also. I'm just wondering how $10 billion in tax breaks for the energy companies is actually an energy bill, and who in their right mind doesn't want their car to go 33 miles a gallon? You know, I don't know. I just don't understand how.
Well, you know who. The oil companies sure don't. And you have Detroit wedded to these bigger cars that get poor mileage per gallon. But that energy bill, you're right, was primarily corporate welfare for large companies who are heavy contributors to the Republican Party, and it was an absolute disgrace.
And we have an oil industry CEO as president, an oil industry CEO as vice president, and Tom DeLay is beholden to the oil industry. It should be no surprise. Well, at that, we've got to wrap it up. Congressman Sanders, Bernie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Louise, by the way, tells me that John Nichols, the guy who is putting on the conference in St. Louis that you're going to be speaking at, is going to be our guest in the next hour. So.
John is dynamite. You'll
yeah,
enjoy it.
He's a good guy. Okay, thanks a lot for being with us, Bernie.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Yep, bye now. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison's, not some right-wing think tank. You are in the real free speech zone, yes, indeed. No barbed wire, no passes from the RNC necessary, no loyalty oaths. No, you can just call in or listen.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. We'll be right back. uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone on the banks of the Willamette River in Portland, Oregon, beaming across the United States. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, if you'd like to call in, if you'd like to drop into our live chat room for some of the finest, most intelligent, thoughtful, thought-provoking, sometimes outrageous, funny, and even sexy and weird conversations. Well, mostly the former, not the latter. But whatever, you know, it's all over. Just go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. It'll get you there. And, of course, you can participate in our message board by clicking on message board, blog and message board at TomHartman.com. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Walt in Crescent City, California is on the line. Hey, Walt, what's up?
Hey, good morning, Tom. I keep getting these things. This is in big red letters on the top of a solicitation to join this man who's a stock advisor. George Bush is about to launch phase two of the war on terrorism with military strikes on Syria and Iran by summer. That's the third one I've got from three different people.
Yeah.
And I'm just relating that to what Bernie said about getting out of Iraq. That's going the other direction.
No, it is going in the other direction, and that's the direction that the Bush administration wants to go. They're very clear that the only way that they can hold on to power in the United States is to terrorize the American people and to continue having external military adventures, because their internal domestic policies are so bad, they are destroying the United States. They have, you know, their war on the working class, their war on unions and organized labor, their war on environmental protections, their war on Social Security, their war on the poor, their war on clean water and food, their war on our environment. All of those things are things that the American people are increasingly becoming aware of and are saying, you know, I'm really not sure we want that. And in fact, most people don't want it. And the only way that these guys can retain power is to say, hey, we're fighting a good fight. We're fighting a battle over there. Because as Bush knows, as Karl Rove pointed out to him in 2002 when they were sitting down in Texas planning the Iraq war, back when they said they weren't, as part of his 2004 election strategy. And I have to say, I'm one of those who doesn't think that we went into Iraq for oil, because we could buy oil from any despot we want. We're buying it from Saudi Arabia right now. I think we went into Iraq as part of George W. Bush's plan to get reelected in 2004. I think it was that banal or banal or however you pronounce it. It was that small. It was that trivial. It was that political. It was that disgusting. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if I've been predicting, actually, that he'll go into Syria this year or early next year to gin it up for the 2006 elections to try and hold on to the Republican majorities in the House and Senate, and that in 2008 we'll be going after Iran. That's my prediction. Scott Ritter thinks we're going to be going after Iran in 2006. We'll see. Time will tell.
What can we do to accelerate the notion in among American people that that this guy wants another war?
Well, speak out. Speak out loudly. Call talk shows, write letters to the editor, talk to your friends, organize gatherings of people to get together and talk about it, show up at meetups. If you can get a hold of a copy, there's copies of Nigel Curtis, I think is his name, the guy who wrote or who produced, actually wrote it as well, wrote and produced the terrorism movie Nightmares.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, what is it about Nightmares? Power of Nightmares. Thank you, Louise. Power of Nightmares. You know, if you can get that and show it to your local community, and I realize maybe I'm advocating bootlegging. If I am, then, you know, beep that out. But in any case, you know, find it need not be that, actually. There's some great videos that Robert Greenwald and Earl Katz put together, you know, unprecedented, unconstitutional. There's a series of them with the uns in the beginning of them that you can get and you can show at local communities, and they encourage people to do that. You know, start waking people up. That's what we have to do. And if enough of us do that at the grassroots level, it will create a critical mass where the media will have to pay attention. And then when the national media starts having to pay attention, then hopefully we can see some kind of change at the politically at the national level.
Okay. Okay. Thanks, Tom.
Step by step, Walt. That's all we can do. Just like the suffragettes did, or the folks in favor of suffrage. I realize suffragette was a negative term back then. Just like the abolitionists did, you know, just like during the civil rights movement, just as in the anti-Vietnam War movement. I mean, it took a lot of years, and it took a lot of people getting shot or shot at and beaten and imprisoned and whatnot. But step by step, you can accomplish these goals if we do it from the grassroots up. Well,
okay.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Harriet in Seattle on the line. Hey, Harriet.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Yes, sun's out. We can't complain. On that wind broadcast that you have throughout the show, and they're talking about Alaska Airlines.
The Workers' Independent News. Now,
yeah.
A lot of folks don't hear that because that plays during the local minutes part of the commercial break when local stations are going to run their own advertisements. So the folks listening to our web stream hear that, but folks listening to our radio stations don't. So you might want to explain what it was that was discussed on the Workers' Independent News.
Oh, okay. Too bad. They're missing a good segment there.
They are, and we're trying to negotiate with them to play it on the main segment of the program, and that's an ongoing thing.
That would help. Yeah, this is regarding Alaska Airlines cutting ramp jobs in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And they were saying it may happen, and I just wanted to say that it has happened. They're laying off 472 ramp workers.
Was that announcement just made?
Yeah, it came out this morning, and they've hired Menzies Aviation to provide their ramp services. And they go on to talk about how nice the severance package is and all that sort of thing. And at the bottom is the real kicker, because it says the displaced workers also may apply for jobs with Menzies, which I found rather something, but that was one point.
Yeah, yeah. And Menzies is not a union shop, and they don't pay a fair
minimum
wage.
No benefits. What else can you say?
Yeah.
But the other thing was, on this Syrian border thing, Le Proletariat brought up a real interesting website last night in the chat room. It's .mil site, osd.mil, and it's a Department of Defense deployments. And when you get down to Iran and Afghanistan, they say see deployments. So going down there, they're showing a combined strength for Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom of 221,000 troops.
Right.
Which is totally in opposition to what we're being fed of how everything's being cut back, and we're down to this and we're down to that.
Hmm.
And
these are the official deployment numbers.
Yep, as of December 2004.
Yeah, and of course this does not include the second largest army in Iraq, which is the Army of American Private Contractors,
right.
The Mercenary Army,
yes.
Which is over 20,000 now.
Yes, and the current bloodbath we're in right now up at the Syrian border kind of leads me along that thought of they're talking about Syria in June, and
yeah.
I think it's a real high probability with this kind of troop strength.
Yeah. Yeah, which is grim. Harriet, thanks for the call, and thanks for informing us about what's going on with Alaskan Airlines and raising these important issues with regard to our unfortunate situation in Iraq. Greg in Michigan on the line in Grand Rapids. Hey, Greg.
Hi. Well, you know, there have been in the past debates upon whether or not there should be a national ID card.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, in order to debate that on the merits of the proposal...
The debate is over, by the way, Greg, because it's just passed, and Bush is going to sign it.
He hasn't signed it yet?
No.
There's no way we can generate an override vehicle to pull that out.
No. What we're going to have to do, and it's interesting, I got a spam email yesterday. I'm on some right-wing lists as well as progressive lists, and I got a spam email from a gun control, freaked out about gun control group, a pro-gun group. And they were just going hysterical. The National ID Act. Now, if you show up at a gun show, you don't even have to buy anything. If you walk in the door of one of these outdoor gun shows, you know, where they got a big tent set up or something, or it's in a high school gymnasium or whatever, you just walk in the door. If there's a federal agent around, or a state agent for that matter, who has a scanner, who can scan your RFID chip that's implanted in your radio frequency identification chip that's implanted in your driver's license, they can get all your personal information from 100 yards away. I mean, they could be parked down the street, and they'll know the identity of every single person who goes into the gun show. And this has the gun loving folks really nervous.
Well, I'll just wrap the thing in a piece of aluminum foil.
Yeah, well, as a matter of fact, it's interesting that you say that. I just got an email, or I got it this morning, from Evelyn in Houston. She says, our youngest son, Nathan, who will be 17 at the end of June, told me that they use aluminum foil around internet cables if there is interference from fluorescent lights in attics. He runs cable for a living. She said, see, the tinfoil hats may just work. The crazies have known this for years. They've talked about this as a way to prevent the government from hearing their thoughts. She says, I see a new business opportunity for someone, aluminum foil-lined wallets to protect one from being detected by Big Brother if you pass by one of the many scanners that will certainly be positioned all around us, just a thought. Now, which raises the question in my mind, you know, the radar detectors are illegal in a lot of states. Are they going to make aluminum foil-covered wallets illegal?
Oh, obviously.
Yeah. So.
All right. But the thing that really bugs the heck out of me is there's been absolutely no media coverage of this over the last several weeks when this thing was being debated.
Other than on Lou Dobbs' show where he was just flogging it because he loves it. You know, because he thinks it's the solution to the immigration problem.
But why was there the fact that there was no debate on this is, well, I'm sorry, my battery's dying. Have a day.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Greg. Sorry about your battery there. In answer to your question, though, there was no debate on it because when they tried to get this through 2 years ago, they tried to get this through the House and Senate, there was no way. The Republicans wouldn't vote for it. And so what they did was they attached it to this bill, this must-pass spending bill. And it was one of those things where there weren't enough Republicans who were strongly opposed to it to stop it, but there were enough who were not in favor of it that it couldn't have passed on its own. And that's why they had to do it by basically a parliamentary procedure, you know, attaching it to another piece of legislation that had to pass rather than putting it on its own. And you're right, there was no debate about it, and that's a bad thing. Mike in Florida on the line. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Tom, I wanted to debate you a little on this reason of going to war.
Sure.
You really seem sold on by Bob Woodward's book that it was pretty much Bush.
Well, it wasn't Woodward's book, because his book doesn't come right out and say that. He provides enough information that you can draw that inference. But, that's what I believe. Yeah.
So you got to rewind before he was even in office, and there's a good article on Mother Jones called The 30-Year Itch about oil and how we wouldn't want to go through that again.
Oh, sure.
And I know you're familiar with PNAC, and that started before Bush was even a dream.
Yep.
And do you think we would be in Iraq if McCain were in there instead of Bush?
No, there's no way.
Right. And one reason...
But the need for oil would be just as real.
Right. But the reason is he's not as easy to manipulate as Bush would be. Which
could
is why
be.
They put him as their man.
Could be. I mean, the flip side of this, though, Mike, is that Bush has, his whole entire life has lived in his father's shadow, hates his father. That's why he hates being called Junior. You know, tried to beat up his father once, and which is in most of his biographies, oddly enough. And I believe one of the subsets of why Bush wanted to go into Iraq was to prove that his father was wrong and that his father should have continued all the way to Baghdad.
Correct. And knowing that, the people that put him into power, the inner circle that's really in control, because you and I know Bush isn't in control, I don't believe.
Yeah.
And knowing that the inner circle is the one who pushed it, that he would be able to fall for this real easy.
Oh, yeah.
Because he wanted to trump his...
Oh, yeah. But I think that Karl Rove also looked at this and said, this is the best way to get reelected since his popularity is tanking.
That in and of itself wouldn't have got us there.
Yeah, perhaps not. But if you add them all up, I think that was probably what pushed it over the top. I may be wrong. I'll say right up front. I don't have a corner on the truth. Yeah, got to control the resources. Well said, Mike. Thanks.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
We were born before the wind. Also younger than the sun. Yeah, the Bonnie boat was won as we sail into the mystic.
Today's Wall Street Journal for Friday the 13th of May. The front page story is rich-poor gap widens in the U.S., class mobility stalls. Figure that. I'll just quote one paragraph here. Although Americans still think of their land as a place of exceptional opportunity, in contrast to class-bound Europe, the evidence suggests otherwise. And scholars have, over the past decade, come to see America as a less mobile society than they once believed. They're on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, a whole article about how the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, and it's harder and harder and harder to break out of whatever category you're into, unless you're rich and you want to become very poor, although the rules are so stacked in favor of the rich that it's even hard to break out of being rich now, according to the Wall Street Journal. Victoria with the Talk Radio News Service with us. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Pretty good, pretty good. In Washington, it's Friday, and we're always pleased on Friday because, you know, they all clear out, and hopefully they can't do too much more damage over the weekend.
Well, you know, in Germany, the official, in German, the official name for a government building, do you know what it is? The German?
No.
It's Rathaus. R-A-T-H-A-U-S. It's actually pronounced.
That.
It's actually pronounced Rathaus, and it means government building. And I always just thought that was a little ironic. I'm going down to the Rathaus to. anyway, so how are things at the Rathaus?
Well, at the white version of the Rathaus, Scott McClellan held his briefing today. I attended, and he was asked a lot of questions about base closings. He was asked a lot of questions about Bolton. Those were the main issues that were going on. There are a few things on other things, but certainly John Bolton, a number of us asked him questions, including yours truly. And it will shock you to hear, Tom, that he didn't answer most of them directly.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm just aghast, Victoria.
No, I thought you would be blown away by that.
What were did any of the questions make him a little uncomfortable?
Well, I thought so. And what's frustrating at the White House is you ask a question, you maybe get a follow-up, and then he moves on, you see. So if you've got a follow-up to the follow-up, you can't always get it in. Well, my question was about, you know, that one of the senators had made the point that, because this is about giving information to the senators who'd asked for it, that the senators didn't work for the president. They're a separate co-equal branch of government. And I said, can they not be trusted to be responsible enough to use that information which is relevant to make that determination and to not use other materials? And
he punted.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah. Has anybody, I'm just curious, Victoria, has anybody ever asked Scotty McClellan if he's the secret friend, the special friend that Jeff Gannon Guckert was visiting on all those times that he came to the White House when there wasn't a press event?
You know something I haven't asked, and I'm not asking that anytime soon.
Because, you know, there's been some rumors about Scotty.
I know there have. But now I do know that Jeff Gannon was seen at the Tom DeLay feast last night.
You're kidding!
Yes, he was there.
He was there. He paid $200 to get there, to get in.
I don't know. Maybe he was a guest of somebody. He was crying out, apparently, to get an invite to the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Incredible.
But he got to this one, yeah.
And then Tom Feeney gets up and says, well, it looks like we're going to have these rules tightened. We don't like it, but we're going to have to do it. Tom Feeney, the guy who now, this guy down in Florida, has issued a sworn deposition, swore before Congress, I mean a felony if it's a lie, that Tom Feeney hired him to write software that would hack a voting machine.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah.
Quite extraordinary.
Yeah. So, anyway, what else?
As far as base closing, Scott McClellan did say that President Bush, he indicated he had not seen the list before it came out, but he wouldn't really be drawn much further than that. But meantime, we've got senior senator from Pennsylvania, Arlen Specter, having an apoplectic fit. He says he's still livid over the previous round of base closing. So, he is furious. Connecticut, of course, has gone ballistic.
Yeah.
And Washington, D.C. is not too happy if they're going to close down Walter Reed, which is extremely important and a huge source of employment for the economically depressed Washington area.
Remarkable. Well, you know, do you think it's a good thing? Do you think that they're doing what needs to be done, or do you think it's a really stupid thing?
I think it's ridiculous. If they want to fight the war on terrorism, then fight the war on terrorism. Don't put people out of work.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Well said. Victoria Jones, thanks for being with us, Victoria.
Thank you.
Give our best to Ellen. We'll see you all next week.
Okay.
Have a good one. Tom Hartman here with you with the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And let's see here. Tony in Grand Rapids on the line. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Hey, Tom. First, as I say in your Jeff Gannon thing that you were talking about, he was on Bill Maher a couple weeks ago, and he said that all those times that he was there where there wasn't any press conferences, he was there in official news business.
Yeah, I know. I saw that. And if you believe that, I have a bridge to sell you.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. But my question for you is, we were talking Democracy for America the other day, and the subject came up, someone threw out the idea that maybe the Social Security thing is just a smoke screen to push through all of his others. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, yes and no. I think that Bush badly misjudged Social Security. He ran basically on a campaign, on a platform of privatizing Social Security when he ran for Congress back 25 years ago and failed. And he didn't win that seat in Texas. Another one of his loser efforts. The guy has been a loser all his life. Every company he started went bust and had to be bailed out by friends and buddies. I don't know why Harry Reid's apologizing for calling him a loser. He is a loser. But in any case, and in my opinion, he lost two presidential elections with that whole another thing.
Sure.
But I think part of it was he overreached. Part of it was this has been the Republican agenda ever since 1937 when they first started trying to stop Social Security because they think it's socialism. And part of it is, yeah, it's a great distraction from all the real problems. I mean, you know, Social Security is going to go broke in 40 years. Medicare is going broke this year. But they're not talking about that. So, you know, I think, Tony, you make a good point. I appreciate the call. I got to move along here. I got a bunch of calls. Tony, thank you so much. Good to hear from you there in Michigan. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Joe in Brookings, Oregon on the line. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Yeah, well, I guess the American Nazi Party wants to run a presidential candidate in 2008. I guess they don't have to look any further than Pat Buchanan.
Yeah, he kind of came out about that this weekend. Although I can tell you, as I talked about on this program yesterday, I heard him speak in Georgia back when he was running for president, and most of his speech was about those people. I mean, the guy clearly is anti-Semitic, if nothing else.
Well, yeah, those remarks you just mentioned they made last week, they're very, very asinine and insane, even by his standards.
Yeah, yeah,
I
agree, Joe.
And he mentioned the thing about Hitler. You know, I always hear this thing about Hitler got elected by the German people.
No, he wasn't. He was appointed by Hindenburg.
Oh, okay. Good.
After the burning of the Reichstag.
Because I hear people repeat that falsehood.
No,
all the time.
Yeah, no, well, you know, later on he might have been elected. I'm not sure. I don't recall, frankly, from my reading of the rise and fall of the Third Reich. But I know in the beginning that he was really jockeying for that position. Linda in Grand Rapids on the line. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I don't know if you know that George Bush is going to be speaking at Calvin College here in Grand Rapids for the commencement.
Right there in the heart of
Michigan.
Next
week? Yeah.
Oh.
Well, apparently Karl Rove got that hooked up for him.
That should be entertaining.
So
you have to be a Republican to get in, no doubt.
Well, I think he's assuming everyone there is going to be Republican, that they're not going to give him a problem. But, you know, Calvin is not your typical fundamentalist Christian college, and there's a large number of people that are excited that he's coming. There's quite a few that are not excited he's coming. And what are you supposed to do in that case? You know, here's your graduation. You want your family and friends to be there, but you have a huge problem with the president and his policies, you know?
Well, that's a tough one. That's a tough one. You're graduating from that college?
No, I'm not graduating, but, you know.
But you know people
who
are.
I know people that are.
Yeah.
And
he's coming to give the commencement speech.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, he's working his base.
Yeah, well, and it's a big deal. I mean, to have the President of the United States give a commencement speech is a big deal, regardless of who the president is. But
right,
it'll be real interesting.
To say no.
Yeah, it's going to be real interesting to see how this plays out. Linda, thanks for raising that. We'll keep our eyes on it and you know, let us know what's going on. I do appreciate it. Real quickly, Tom in Minnesota. I've got a couple of guests here I want to get to, Tom. What's up?
Oh, okay. I wanted to talk quickly about David Brooks' recent article, but it sounds like I don't have enough time to cover that.
Yeah, let's get into that in the next hour or early next week, because that's the sort of thing that can hold, and I know where you're going with it, and it's a good topic, but I do want to move on to the best of the rest of the news here. Bill Moyer is with us, and John Nichols. Whoops. Hang on just a second. Let me just lock that.
Hello?
Hey, John, hang on just a minute. I'm sorry. Louise, I just dumped Bill Moyer.
Oh, we can talk, brother.
Yeah, we can. There you go. John Nichols is with us. John is the co-founder of Free Press, which organized the three-day national conference for media reform that began today in St. Louis. And in a few minutes, we're going to have Bill Moyer, the director and co-founder of the Backbone Campaign, on. We talk about the news of the week. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
It's a delight to be on with you.
Oh, it's great to have you here.
And you do a great show. You're not what we want to reform. We want more of you.
Well, thank you. I am part of the reform here.
Yeah, it is. Well, let's... You should see this conference. We have tons of journalists here.
Yeah? Well, tell
people
me about
who
it.
Do it. Well, go ahead. The conference is incredible. I was out doing radio interviews yesterday afternoon as people were driving up, and it was just amazing. Carloads driven from California, from Virginia, you know, all over the country. We have people from all 50 states, from the District of Columbia, from Puerto Rico, from 12 different countries around the world, more than 2,000. In fact, we've had to close registrations because so many have showed up, although we're still kind of letting folks in. We're going to have Al Franken and Jim Hightower, Amy Goodman, of course, but also Patti Smith, the legendary rock star, and Bill Moyers, who has just decided a day or so ago to come out. He'll deliver our final address and talk about the crisis with public broadcasting.
Yeah, that's great. And Bernie Sanders, who is on our show every Friday, he was just on last hour.
He's our biggest rock star of all.
Yeah, he said he's going to be there. He's all excited about it.
We have three members of Congress, a couple of FCC commissioners. But the really important thing about this gathering is that we have thousands of grassroots activists from across the country who are furious about what's happened with our media, about a media that will allow the president to lie us into an unjust and illegal war, about a media that will allow the 2004 campaign to turn into a fantasy discussion of John Kerry's Vietnam service rather than a real discussion about Social Security, the economy, and, of course, the war itself.
Yeah. And what, looking back over this last week, John, I'm guessing that one of what, in your mind, would be considered one of the biggest stories of the last week was the leaking of this memo in the U.K.
Absolutely. And it's the last several weeks. I mean, this
came out on May 5th, as I recall.
Well, and
here, or was it May
1st? Actually, a little before. May 1st.
May 1st.
And this is the critical thing. If a country has a media that's actually serious about covering the news rather than Michael Jackson and the runaway bride, it keeps on stories and it tries to figure out explanations so people know what's going on. Britain had its national elections on May 5th. The major British newspapers, conservative and liberal, were all continually trying to dig up stuff on Tony Blair as the election approached. One of the things they dug up, of course, was that his own attorney general had concerns that if Britain entered the war on the side of George Bush, that British soldiers could be charged with war crimes because it was an illegal war. This is an incredible revelation, and there's all sorts of details that have come out. What's significant about that is it came out in the days before a national election. Now, compare that to the United States. In the weeks before the 2004 election, CBS announced that it wasn't going to broadcast a report that it had been working on for 6 months about the lies and deceptions that on the part of the Bush administration that led to the war in Iraq, because they said explicitly they didn't want to affect the national election.
And that report to this day has not seen the light of day.
You are exactly right. Now, compare those two systems. Understand that that's what we're talking about here. We have a media system in this country that does not give citizens the information they need to make informed decisions on election day. In England and other countries, they have a better system, not a perfect one, but a better. What we're saying, what all these activists are saying is, we need to start tearing apart our existing media system, getting to the rot that is inside it, cutting that out, and replacing it with a system that informs citizens, that lets citizens express their views, and finally, it gives us back our culture so we don't have 24/7 formatted radio, you know, infotainment TV that is irrelevant, and commercials upon commercials upon commercials.
John Nichols, do you think that part of that rot might have to do with the repealing of various regulations in the late 80s and also the Telecommunications Act in 96, which basically allowed corporations that were offering news programming that prior to these rules changes was part of their public service obligation. They were fulfilling their public service obligation by having the news, and therefore the news departments, whether they made money or not, didn't matter.
Right.
And when there was no longer a public service requirement, they said, well, we have this tradition of doing the news. Let's turn it into part of the profit structure of this company. And all of a sudden, the focus of the news shifted. It shifted somewhat in the late 80s, and it shifted big time after 96.
Well, Tom, this is why you have a big time radio show, because you actually know about a few things that happened in our history. What you speak about is exactly true, and it is exactly what did happen. When the networks, especially television networks and radio networks, started to make their news operations profit centers as opposed to a separate entity, you know, that was sort of protected within the overall corporate structure and was supposed to inform people, you saw a huge change. Suddenly they had to every day find the sexiest, the dirtiest, the slimiest, the most titillating story. That's why we followed this poor woman in Georgia, the runaway bride. I mean, don't you think that in this country you ought to have a right to decide not to marry without having the entire country watch it?
Yeah, I mean, this is really a local story, if it's even a story.
It's garbage. Look, if I decide not to get married, I would, you know, that's my own personal trauma. I'd like to do it on my own.
Yeah.
You know? And,
yeah.
And so, but that isn't, it has nothing to do with the people of Georgia. It has nothing to do with the American people demanding those stories. It has to do with a media system that's gone to the lowest common denominator.
Yeah.
And that's not the only, just to finish, that's not the only decision. They took away the fairness doctrine, so people can't respond. They did the Telecommunications Act of 1996 that said that previously you could only own a handful of stations. Now Clear Channel owns 1,200. Again and again and again, the government has made decisions in our name about our airwaves, but without our informed consent. What this media reform movement is saying is no more. From here on out, those decisions are made with us at the table.
Well said. Okay, well, along with us here, along with John Nichols, the co-founder of Free Press, which organized the three-day national conference for media reform that began today in St. Louis. Along with us is Bill Moyer, not Bill Moyers, but Bill Moyer, the director and co-founder of the Backbone Campaign, a grassroots effort to embolden citizens and elected officials to stand up for progressive values. Hey, Bill.
Hello. It's an honor to be on with John Nichols. Hello, John.
Hello, Bill. We've worked together before. Bill is not only part of the Backbone Project, but also a great media reformer out on the West Coast.
Well, at least I'm friends with great media reformers. We've got folks at Reclaim the Media who are already landed in St. Louis, I believe, yesterday.
Yep.
Yep.
That's great. So, Bill, what do you see as the big stories over this past week? And what are the issues are you looking at? And have you given out a Backbone Campaign Award recently?
Well, there haven't been a lot of backbone awards to go out lately. We would like to collaborate with some folks around the country to get Maxine Waters a Backbone Award for her work trying to save the life of Prime Minister Von Neptune down in Haiti and her consistent efforts around fighting for democracy in Haiti. I don't know if you got to hear Amy Goodman's interview with President Aristide this last week, but that was a very compelling interview, called conscience to the American people for our long history and its impact on the people of Haiti.
Yeah, so Haiti being the first nation in this hemisphere that declared that their slaves were free.
Exactly. So we have a debt to pay there, and if folks are interested in helping us get a Backbone Award to Maxine Waters, we'd sure love to do that. The other person we'd love to get a Backbone Award to would be Elliot Spitzer for all his good work in New York State. We have been engaged in some spineless citations for in the last few weeks for folks who voted against the bankruptcy bill. We also did
spineless Democrats. I'm assuming you're talking about.
They claim to be that we have no place else to go, and yet they continue often to ignore the platform, the documents that were created by the grassroots. Obviously, there's multiple examples of that recently. The Hawaiian senators who voted to open up ANWR, absolutely in contradiction to a resolution passed in Hawaii by the members of the state Democratic Party there, Senators Inouye and Akaka. And so we've been running a radio ad out there in Hawaii and having folks download spinal citations for them for that action. We've also been thanking some of the Democrats who are come lately to the progressives, calling themselves progressives, and we're very happy that it's so hip to be progressive that, you know, folks like Adam Smith of the New Democrat Coalition are deciding that that the bankruptcy bill and CAFTA are the wrong direction for this country. They may not be articulating that in the same way that you or I might articulate that opposition to that, but I think that in the last week or so that that's pretty big news to have those folks turn around on CAFTA.
Yeah.
And so we were part of that with the labor movement because we wanted to thank Adam Smith and those folks who did change their position, and we visited his office with the Steelworkers Union folks down in Tacoma, Washington.
Good on you.
And so it was good. You know, it's nice to see.
Yeah.
Nice to see that there's some.
So, Bill Moyer, we have about a minute and a half left, and I'd like to get a little feedback from both of you. What do you see as the big story coming up next week? Bill Moyer first.
Well, obviously, filibuster is a huge issue, and we can't allow the Democrats to get weak on this.
Yeah.
They got weak on Gonzales, and they thought it was good enough to just vote no. We in the grassroots do not think that no is adequate.
Okay.
They need to shut things down and
slam the door. Slam the door. John Nichols, what do you think is coming up?
The big story of the next week. The other Bill Moyer, the one with the S on it,
right.
Bill Moyers,
right.
Is going to speak out on Sunday, starting the week, with a condemnation of the Bush administration and their interference with public broadcasting, the interference that actually led essentially to him being forced off the air.
Yeah.
And you're going to see an expose of how the White House has manipulated the public broadcasting system in this country. I think that issue is going to blow wide open, and I do believe that is going to be one of the most serious discussions we've had in this country in years about spin and manipulation of the media.
I'll tell you, it's a big deal. I do a local show in Portland, Oregon before I do this program. And
people are mad.
I mentioned this last week, and we got a call from the local public broadcasting station saying, what? And, you know, you said on the air that Karl Rove's childhood friend is now in charge of CPB, and I said, yeah, and it's true. And she's like, whoa.
This is a hell of a story.
Yeah, the affiliates don't even know it. You know, they're just starting to figure it out. Okay, John Nichols, freepress.net, and Bill Moyer. What's your website there, Bill?
Backbonecampaign.org.
Backbonecampaign.org. Thanks to both of you for being with
us
today.
Thanks for having us on.
I truly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good guys. Keep up the great work. Tom Hartman here with you, 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
No one knows what it's like to feel these feelings like I do.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman with you 5 minutes before the hour. Usually a bug dies, writes David Brooks. Yeah, we'll get back to that in a few minutes. Somebody called in, by the way, during the break, and said that they were of the opinion, or they had read somewhere, or they thought that perhaps CNN was reporting that a lot of the base closings actually had to do with outsourcing jobs that were being done by federal employees to Halliburton and other friends of the administration. And so I'm in search of that story. If anybody in the chat room has any information on that, if you can track down a link for me, let me know, and I'll go find it at the news at the top of the hour here. We can present it during the next hour. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Tom in Minnesota on the line. Hey, Tom, you wanted to talk about David Brooks's column?
Yeah, not the recent one, the one before, the one entitled Stuck in Lincoln's Land. Did you read that?
Oh, no, okay. I'm mixed up here.
About the Bolton one, right?
Yeah, yeah.
No, the one before that, it's a misnomer entitled. It's really a battle. He's talking about secularism. And you got to look at that, how he's manipulating and trying to distort words and stuff. And I wanted to get on this, how they hijack language. And the
mm-hmm.
Democrats are so slow to respond on this obvious tactic, you know. But they keep using this word secularism to mean atheistic, you know, non-spiritual. And secular means civil. There are a lot of religious secular people like Martin Luther King, who was, and President Carter, who were religious folk who believe in civil secular courts, not religious courts. But these guys keep trying to use the word secular to mean these non-believing, godless people. Right.
Right. What they're turning it into is a polarity where, on the one hand, you have people who are believers and people of faith who also believe that government should be run by the church or should be run in accordance with the principles of the church, and that in their world, on the other hand, you have people who have no faith and therefore believe that government should have nothing to do with the church, completely leaving out the probably 80% of Americans, maybe even 90% of Americans, and certainly all of the founding fathers, who were of the opinion that church is fine and government has nothing to do with it, and vice versa.
Right. So if you look at his piece, and I've heard this in other right-wingers, and they're using, must be a Frank Luntz thing, the word secularism, and they're trying to, just like they did with democracy and all the other stuff.
Yeah, yeah, just reinvent language.
Exactly.
Good one. Okay, I'll go back and look for that. I've got the archive.
It's pretty
here.
Blatant. You'll notice what I'm
okay.
talking about.
Tom, thanks for the tip. Yeah. I do appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Always good to hear from you. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Yes. Not to mention the weapons of mass destruction. Just look at our commercial infrastructure. Drive through any of the big cities in America. Defending America from the conservative weapons, period. It's Tom Hartman here with you. the Tom Hartman radio program. And happy Friday 13th to you, too.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Happy Friday the 13th. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, streaming down from outer space in the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, American FM on live365.com. And on cable systems in 29 states on CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. Population Connection is the group that was once known as Zero Population Growth, ZPG. And it's an interesting issues here. This being time for our regular, although we're a day off, our regular Everything You Know Is Wrong spot or moment of time here.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync and think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Maybe what you know that you don't know, or maybe you don't know what you do know about population is wrong. Let's find out. John Seegers with Population Connection, formerly Zero Population Growth, the largest grassroots group in the country mobilizing Americans to meet the global population challenge. He's been working with Population Connection since 1996, was appointed president and CEO by the board of directors January 1st of this year. Before that, he was with the EPA and worked for U.S. Representative Peter Kostmeyer. Hey, John, how you doing?
Great. How are you, Tom?
I am fine. Population growth. What's the status of this right now? What's the whole? It seems like a lot of folks think that, for example, Paul Ehrlich's book, The Population Bomb, has been discredited. My take on it is that he was absolutely right. But what's the real story, for example?
Well, population growth really started, for all practical purposes, around the time Thomas Jefferson became president, and it happened. Because of some good things, the advent of modern medicine and modern sanitation. It wasn't so much that people who managed to survive to old age are living longer, it's just that more of us are surviving infancy. That's really what caused the dramatic change. Up until around 1800, there was little or no population growth. It had taken us since the beginning of, if not of time, the beginning of the time at which we started walking around on our hind legs about 1.8 million years ago, to get to a billion people. By the end of the 19th century, we had 1.6 billion people. By the end of the 20th century, we had 6.1 billion people, and it continues to grow by some 70 million people a year. So it's very much a real factor. Virtually all of that growth is occurring in the poorest places on Earth. As for what Paul Ehrlich said, that book, The Population Bomb, was written in 1968. Not everything that he predicted has happened exactly the way he thought it might, but imagine a book written on race relations in the United States that same year, the year Dr. King was assassinated, or imagine a book written about personal computers in 1968, which was the year Texas Instruments came out with its first programmable calculator. Things have a way of changing in unexpected ways, but the basic premise that human population growth is a major factor in the world remains correct. And the basic premise that it's causing a lot of misery and a lot of problems remains correct.
Well, and in fact, Paul Ehrlich, I mean, he had his famous bet with Julian Simon about the basket of commodities, zinc and nickel and copper and whatnot. And Ehrlich had predicted that they would go up in price because they would be less available. The scarcity would increase. And Simon said, no, they'll actually go down. And Simon was right. But Paul Ehrlich's main premise was that population growth over time degrades the quality of life, and that by this point in time, right now, you would have mass starvation going on in the world. And in fact, there is mass starvation going on in the world.
That's absolutely right. 20,000 children every day die needlessly.
Yeah.
Not one of them dies of overpopulation directly. Very few of them starve to death. They die because they are malnourished, because they succumb to easily preventable diseases. If 20,000 children a day isn't enough to create a crisis, I don't know what is.
Yeah. So there is a real problem here. One of the things that has fascinated me is the concern that seems to be sweeping across Europe and the United States, for that matter, particularly among the conservatives and the Catholics. But I see it as broader than that. I think, you know, the Catholics have this issue, the official Catholic. I'm talking about the Vatican has this official thing of they just passed 1 billion people. They want to have 2 billion people, not just through evangelism, but, you know, have a baby for the church kind of thing. And in fact, I've talked to Catholics who've been told that they were told that as young people, you know, grow up and have children for the church. But this promotion of the idea that if population reverses itself and starts diminishing, as it is in some European countries, and as some parts of the population of the United States have, for example, you know, Caucasians in the United States, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, are in negative population growth in the United States, that's somehow a bad thing. And I remember back when I was in, I don't remember if it was high school or college, but reading the history of the Black Plague in Europe. And there are people who say, and historians, and I think credibly, that the reason the Renaissance happened was because the Black Plague wiped out a third of the population of Europe, and that changed the human versus resource ratio such that people now had leisure time. There was more resources. They didn't have to work as hard. They didn't have to compete as intensely. There were more resources. People had a little more free time, and they were able to pursue things like art and invention and theory and mathematics and whatnot, and that without the Black Plague, we wouldn't have had the Renaissance.
Well, I'll defer to you on matters of pre-Renaissance history because it would take about 20 seconds for me to tell you everything I know about it.
But I guess the point is, isn't it true that a declining population actually increases the quality of life for its people rather than this hysteria that seems to be, which it seems to me in most cases either to be ethnically based or racially based? You know, gee, our race is falling behind or our religion is falling behind, therefore we've got to have more babies. That seems to be the real issue, not what's best for all people.
Well, a couple of things, Tom. I'm in the rather slow process, and I think you know the process, of writing a book on that very subject, the title of which is The Good Crisis, because there is indeed a trend in the most highly developed places on Earth, the most affluent places on Earth, towards smaller families. And it is being termed by some of what I call the new Malthusians, the naysayers, as a crisis, and I think it's really a good crisis. Now, population stabilization, population decline, can be good or it can be bad, because we've always got, in my view, to look at things from the point of view of basic human decency and social justice. What's happening in, for example, Western Europe, where people are having very small families, in Italy, that most Catholic of countries, women have an average of 1.2 children. And that, I think, on balance, is a very good thing, because most of them are doing it as a matter of choice in an affluent society. When you look at Russia, for example, and certain parts of the former Soviet Union, people are having very small families, but when you look behind the numbers, you discover it's because of some sad and even tragic reasons.
Infant mortality.
Infant mortality, horrific environmental conditions, a frayed social network. All those kinds of things add up to a bad situation.
Yeah.
But we are now at the point, for the first time, where we can envision a world in which people can live decent lives, and we find that when people have options, they choose smaller families. And I think that's all to the good. If it's a crisis, as some people claim, I think it might be the first good crisis we've ever had, and about time, considering some of the other ones we're dealing with.
Yeah, my recollection, in fact, from that class where we studied the Black Death and the Renaissance was that somebody had made the assertion, I don't recall if it was a book or if it was one of my professors or whatever, that the Roaring Twenties in the United States were fueled in some part because of the great flu pandemic that killed millions of people around the world in 1918 through 1922. and that that, again, reduced population pressure versus resources, and there, all of a sudden there were a lot of jobs that needed to be filled, and boom, you had this little boomlet that lasted about 10 years till, you know, ran head first into the Great Depression. May or may not be the case. So, you know, apparently it's not your area of expertise, and it certainly isn't mine. I'm just sharing this.
I tend to have a bit of a different take on the issue, but it's probably just because of where I come from on the issue. It's not because I have a sort of an armada of facts that I can put out on the seas here. And that is that what we're seeing now today are some very good things happening in some places on Earth. Let's take Mexico as an example. A generation and a half ago, the average woman in Mexico had 7 children.
Right.
Very poor economic conditions, very poor social conditions. A lot of kids were dying. Now, and this may come as a surprise to some people, the average woman in Mexico has less than 3 children, about 2.8. There's been a dramatic change. And so you see it not just in the most affluent countries, but even in countries that are not as well off economically, although by no means without resources.
Right.
Where women have good choices, where they have some options, they choose smaller families.
Well, what it boils down to is where women have relatively equal power with men, they have smaller families. And because there are, for example, several of the Arab countries, the Gulf countries, where there's no shortage of birth control available. I mean, there's no injunction against it like there is in some Catholic countries where pharmacists are actually afraid to sell condoms for fear they'll burn in hell forever. In the Arab countries where there's, you know, birth control is freely available, still women are having 7, 8, 9 children in some of these countries because they have no power, because they're the property of their husbands.
That's absolutely true. Then you can look at other Islamic nations, such as Iran, for example, which is certainly as Islamic as Saudi Arabia, and yet they have very small families because sex education is an important part of the program there, because people are encouraged to look at options. You look at Saudi Arabia, where Wahhabism, which is a fundamentalist Islamic sect, prevails. Women have very large families.
Right.
So
and Saudi Arabia is spiraling downward right now as a consequence of that.
It certainly is facing a lot of problems, and none of them are being helped by the size of the families.
By this demographic boom. We have about a minute and a half left. We're talking with John Seeger of Population Connection, formerly ZPG, Zero Population Growth. John, when a population does go into decline, however, doesn't that mean that there's going to be a one-generation crisis, as it were, where you've got a lot of very older people and a lot of younger people and not a lot in the middle?
I don't believe so. For example, when you have that kind of situation unfolding, you may need more nursing homes. You'll probably need fewer elementary schools.
Uh-huh.
You may need more gerontologists. You'll probably need fewer pediatricians.
But if you have an elderly population, I mean, this is sort of what we're facing with the baby boomers retiring in the United States, sort of writ small rather than writ large. But you have a population that is less capable of being productive and a more intense drain on resources such as medical services. No.
Well, what you actually have is three pieces. You have people in, say, their first 20 or so years of life who tend to be dependent, people in the middle 40 or so who tend to be employed, and people in the last 20 who may need some help.
Yeah, interesting. Your website, John?
Our website is populationconnection.org.
Populationconnection.org. John Seeger, thanks so much for being with us today, John.
Thank you.
I truly appreciate it. Keep up the good work you guys are doing there. Good on you. 29 minutes, 30 minutes, 20 minutes, 20 minutes past the hour. It's Friday the 13th. Tom Hartman here with you.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Take me for you stole my heart and now you're back for more. Ain't no way you're coming through that door. What kind of fool do you take me for?
Yeah, George. What kind of fool do you take us for? I don't. Oh, my. Happy Friday the 13th, my friends. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Tom DeLay last night. Tom DeLay. This is incredible. Tom DeLay last night at his gala fundraiser, $250 plate dinner, which was attended by Jeff Gannon Guckert, by the way, the gay prostitute who was visiting his special friend at the White House on a regular basis. Tom DeLay last night, along with Jeff Gannon and Tom Feeney, the congressman from Florida who hired Clint Curtis to write vote hacking software. Tom DeLay said that the Democratic Party is a party with no ideas and no class. This is a man whose only idea is money and power, whose only ideas are money and power, and whose idea of class is to go to Saipan in the Marianas Islands, a U.S. protectorate, and lobby against there being a minimum wage, so that the companies who were sponsoring his trip can continue to have slave labor to manufacture the clothing that they then sell here in the United States. This is a guy who is attacking the Democrats for having no class. No class. The crowd dined on filet mignon, salmon, and a dessert of red, white, and blue frosted cake. I guess decorated with candy hammers. Where are the sickles? I mean, all his corporate friends are in bed with China, communist China. Where's the sickles to go with those hammers, Mr. DeLay? Outside the hotel, protesters holding signs that said, Congress can't police itself. And Congress, owned and operated by Tom DeLay. We're here tonight not because Tom DeLay needs help, but because we conservatives continue to need his help, said David Keene, president of the American Conservative Union, adding that DeLay is being unfairly attacked. Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is a real witch hunt. The Democrats have hired a special prosecutor. They've spent $70 million hunting this guy down. Oh, I'm sorry. That was the Republicans with Bill Clinton, wasn't it? Well, the Democrats have been digging out people who, in the Tom DeLay's past, who are questionable, who claim that DeLay has done terrible things, but don't have anything to back it up. Oh, I'm sorry. That was Bill Clinton, wasn't it? They actually have the American Express receipts for Tom DeLay, don't they? Yeah, a little uncomfortable. Tom DeLay. Meanwhile, the White House economist contradicts George W. Bush. For the past few months, while pitching his plan to privatize Social Security, President Bush has repeatedly assured Americans that their accounts could be passed down to their children and that the government would not slash survivor benefits. But yesterday's remarks by the Bush administration's top economist indicate that neither of these statements is true. According to White House estimates, up to 30% of lower-income Americans won't be able to leave their accounts to their children. The White House also admitted that it plans to cut survivor benefits for middle-class Americans. Now they tell us. And you wonder, how many people are actually going to hear this message? Do you think that there's going to be a headline in USA Today that says, White House economist, actually George Bush's point man on Social Security, National Economic Council Chairman Glenn Hubbard, that Glenn Hubbard comes out and says Bush is going to cut your benefits? That even if you have private accounts, only 30% of you are going to get less than you would have otherwise? Somehow I rather doubt it. You think it'll be in the headline in the New York Times? I rather doubt it. Do you think that NBC will lead the news with it tonight when Brian Williams gets up there, the guy who says that it's part of his duty as an American, but listen to Rush Limbaugh every day to read the news to us? You think he'll tell us? Somehow I doubt it. Tom Hartman with you, 29 minutes past the hour on the True People's Radio.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to News Without Conflicts of Global Corporate Interest. Tom Hartman here with you 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, if you'd like to drop in telephonically, if you'd like to drop in via the web, our chat room, live chat, go to TomHartmann.com. However you spell it, will get you there within reason. And click live chat, and that will get you there. You know, they say that pornography and gambling drive technology. This is a kind of little-known factoid. Roughly, now this statistic is a couple of years old. I don't know if it's still the case right now, but I know that 3 or 4 years ago, roughly half of all Internet activity in terms of total number of packets transferred had to do with pornography, had to do with the delivery or the viewing of pornography. And it was because of this and because of the enormous profits to be made with Internet pornography that a lot of the video technologies that are today just very common, video cameras, the MP3 video cameras, and the JPEGs and all these, a lot of this stuff was developed and was fine-tuned. Similarly, online gambling led the charge for online commerce and a lot of the interactive technologies. These are both multi-billion-dollar industries. Well, now it gets even stranger. And this is where, again, it's the omens of things to come. Today's Wall Street Journal article by Peter Sanders. The blackjack tables at the Hard Rock Cafe and Casino here are packed with gamblers and casino voyeurs on a recent weekend. And then they talk about the Peacock Lounge. This is the place where you can't get in unless you're a high roller. And the minimum bet is $100. Every chip is worth $100. And they say, and they say the casino enjoyed an added advantage to its already stacked odds. Now, what would that be? Well, the reason, they say, involves a high-tech chip within a chip that is helping the Hard Rock learn more than ever about every move made by the high rollers. Computer chips embedded in the plastic gambling chips communicate via radio frequency with sensors placed under the felt table. The technology gives the casino operators a trove of knowledge, everything from a player's average bet to where each high-denomination chip is at all times. Now, why am I telling you this? Because any day now, probably today, George Bush Jr. is going to sign into law. He's going to sign into law the emergency appropriation for Iraq, which includes the Real ID Act. And the Real ID Act is going to cause every state to have to generate a standardized driver's license, which will have in it a radio frequency ID chip, as well as a biometric indicator. In other words, it has digitally stored your fingerprint, your iris scan, your voice print, or your DNA. And it's on an RFID chip so that anybody in the vicinity, anybody within a city block of you, can simply scan it and know who you are and all your personal details, where you live, what your arrest record is, what your medical history is, what your purchasing history is. Every store, as you walk into the store, knows that you're there. They know who you are. Remember that movie with Tom Cruise where he walks into the store? Hello, Mr. Johnson. How is Mrs. Johnson? You know, she bought a purse last week. Would she like a scarf to go with it? That kind of thing. This is the face of things to come, and the technology is being developed here in the gambling world. In fact, they note in the Wall Street Journal, until recently, RFID had been cost prohibitive for widespread use at casinos. 3 years ago, a single RFID casino chip cost about $6.25. Today, that number is closer to $1.25 versus about 70 cents for a regular casino chip. Every chip is unique, so they know where every chip is at all times. They know whether you wiggle them back and forth. They know what you're betting them on. They can follow every single chip, just like soon they will be able to follow you and me. Now, what I think is really weird is that there are a few progressives who seem to have some concern about this, but I haven't seen much about it, frankly, in the progressive press. And frankly, I haven't seen much among the conservatives outside of the folks who are concerned about their Second Amendment rights, about, you know, gun rights, and they want to be able to go to gun shows and buy guns without anybody knowing who they are. You know, the survivalists and the Posse Comitatus folks, you know, the militias. They're very worried about this. But I think that this is something that all Americans should be concerned about. I mean, this is a big deal. And, why it's not being discussed in other venues baffles me. Just baffles me. And so I would encourage you, if you listen to other radio programs, to start calling in and saying, hey, what's the deal here? You mean from now on, if I go out to protest Bush showing up in town, the police immediately know who I am and that I'm there, and then they can take that information and they can deliver it to, or for that matter, not just the police, I mean the local bookstore can show up and know that I'm there and then send me a flyer saying, hey, would you like to buy some books about how Bush is a crook? Has it come to this? Yes. This is where we're at. As Freddie points out in the chat room, it doesn't go into full effect for a couple of years. He says 5 years. I thought it was 3 years. I thought it was just before the 2008 elections. I may be wrong on that. But this is a significant issue. This is a real issue. This is something that, in my opinion, we need to be concerned about. There was no discussion of this in Congress. None. Got slapped on and moved along, and the Republicans said, okay, cool. Now, why would the cons in the Republican Party be saying, this is fine? I have a feeling it's going to really concern their own base. In fact, I have a feeling that when the Christian right wakes up to this, that the Pat Robertsons and Jerry Falwells of the world, who I think, you know, still are fond of the idea of having some privacy in America, if for no other reason that they don't want us to know what they're doing, are going to start getting a little nervous. Do we really want the Real ID Act? I don't think so. Is illegal immigration a problem? Yes, of course. Is this the way to combat it? No. What's the real problem with illegal immigration? The real problem is the fact that that labor standards in the United States have been so degraded by Walmart becoming our largest employer rather than General Motors, that we've created fertile ground for immigrants to come into this country. So many of our jobs now are the very bottom of the barrel jobs. And of course, the right wingers say, well, you know, Americans won't do those jobs. Nonsense. Americans will do any job. They just have to be paid appropriately. The real truth is that Americans won't do those jobs at that pay. But illegal immigrants will. And so they're coming to the United States because what has happened is, as the middle class has gotten wiped out and turned into the working poor, when somebody comes up here from Mexico and takes a working poor category job in the United States, they're the middle class in Mexico. And they can go back after a couple of years. They can send money back to their family. They can sustain their family. In fact, about 10% of the Mexican economy is money being sent back to Mexico from illegal immigrants working in the United States. But the way to deal with this is not by putting an RFID chip on everybody. They'll figure out a way to phony those things up, too. No, the way to deal with it is by repealing the Taft-Hartley law and going back to the Wagner Act and saying, hey, people have a right to a decent wage in the United States. People have a right to workplace democracy, to unions in the United States. Putting back into place protectionist trade tariffs, trade policies that actually protect our industries. Yes, protectionism is a good thing. It means protecting you and me. And enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and breaking up these big conglomerates and combines that, you know, in the name of efficiency, have laid off millions of Americans in the last 25 years. Basically, reversing the 25 years of warfare that has been declared and waged on the American middle class by conservatives, Democratic and Republican, although largely Republican, reversing that and going back to the policies that we had in place, and the taxation policies, by the way, that we had in place up until Ronald Reagan came into office. I mean, the week before Ronald Reagan came into office, the top tax rate in the United States was 70%. And we had prosperity in this country. Now you have a top tax rate in the 30s, and we have poverty in this country. Do you notice that there might be a correlation between the two? 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Alan in Georgia on the line. Hey, Alan, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Yeah, I was thinking that the way the Democrats, people on the left, should start framing their debate is what the neocons are doing is they're taking away our great American symbols, not just issues, but symbols.
For example, the flag, you mean?
Like the living wage and... clean air and national forest. All these things are American symbols that both parties have fought for.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, for example, our national parks were the creation, by and large, of Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican Roosevelt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was thinking if you frame them as symbols, maybe that would make a difference.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Let me ponder that, Alan. Good suggestion. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. 16 minutes before the hour on the Tom Hartman program. We also wanted to share a little bit of interesting science with you. Every now and then you see these things and it's like, whoa, this is also in today's Wall Street Journal. Last month, scientists reported that a child whose grandmother smoked while pregnant with the child's mother has twice the risk of developing asthma as a child whose grandma didn't flood her fetus with carcinogens. Now, you get this? If your grandmother smoked, not around you, if your grandmother smoked, you're twice as likely to have asthma. Why would that be? In fact, the risk from grandmother's smoking is greater than the risk from mom smoking. Why would that be? Kids whose mothers smoked while pregnant were 1.5 times more likely to develop childhood asthma, whereas children whose grandmothers smoked were 2.1 times as likely to develop asthma. Turns out that the DNA destructive effects of tobacco smoke, its ability to go in and alter DNA in a way that is harmful, is multigenerational. And in fact, because a woman is born with all of her eggs, if mom is smoking, I mean, her eggs are there, they're fully formed, and so her smoking is going to have some impact on the developing child, but it's not going to harm the DNA of those eggs. Whereas if grandma smoked, that means that mom's ova, mom's eggs are going to have damage from grandmother's smoke. Is this amazing? They're finding that this is true of a whole lot of different things as well. If mom is malnourished during pregnancy, the child will be more susceptible to obesity. Very vulnerable to obesity because mom was malnourished during pregnancy, because the child will develop a metabolism that's like grab whatever you can nutritionally. So if mom lost weight during pregnancy, you've got this, and then the child is more at risk for type 2 diabetes. Babies born to moms with gestational diabetes have a higher risk of type 2 diabetes. When undernourished fetuses grow into adolescence, they don't respond as well to vaccines as babies who had a healthy gestation. Fascinating stuff. And really what it says, you know, when we get right down to it, we get back to this thing about what's the difference between an investment and an expense. In the United States, the cons have succeeded in changing the national dialogue, in changing the national discussion. Back in the 60s, when Lyndon Johnson was talking about the Great Society, and he was pointing out that we had a lot of poverty in the United States and a lot of malnourished children, and he cut poverty in half in 3 years. And he was pointing out that this poverty doesn't just affect the people who are poor. It affects all of us, and it affects us in a wide variety of ways. It affects us in that it produces more criminals. It affects us in that you have a lot of lost potential. Fewer people coming out of those parts of the country or out of those neighborhoods or whatever who will be the scientists and the statesmen and the lawyers and the doctors and whatnot of the next generation. It affects us that fewer of those people are actually going to even work in factories and you know, be part of the middle class in America in that generation because they're growing up in poverty. Their IQ may be lower as a consequence of exposure to lead or as a consequence of malnutrition. All of these problems. And so Lyndon Johnson framed the Great Society as an investment in the future. We're going to invest in these people and these children, and the result of that investment is that we will have a better world a generation down the road. And in fact, he was right. He cut poverty, and it reduced all sorts of social ills. And now come the cons, and they say, oh, no. You're not investing in people when you lift them out of poverty. You're creating an expense for the rich people. It's a transfer of wealth. You're taking from those who have and giving to those who don't have. Those who don't have are not as deserving. They're lazy. And it's not an investment. It's an expense. And it's an expense society shouldn't have to bear. This is the conservative point of view. And then we read studies like this in the Wall Street Journal, in the conservative Wall Street Journal. that point out that if you are providing maternal care, I mean, here's what you could extrapolate from it. If we are providing maternal care, if we're taking good care of pregnant women, that their grandchildren are going to be healthier. If we're helping pregnant women to quit smoking, their grandchildren are going to be healthier. If we're helping pregnant women have a normal pregnancy, their grandchildren are going to be less likely to have diabetes and cancer and other problems. And as a consequence, society will be healthier, our medical expenses will be lower, we'll have a more productive working populace. Boy, when you know in the Bible where it says the sins of the fathers are visited to the seventh generation, we had no idea. It was true. It's time for us to begin framing our conversation about poverty in the United States, about social programs in the United States, once again, as investments. Investments in a future that our children deserve. Investments in creating the world that we would love to have, but we're probably not going to live to see, because these investments actually will pay dividends, as we see from this article, not just in the next generation, but even in the generation after that, and presumably in generations beyond that. It's time for us to invest in human beings once again. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Yeah, if we're going to take democracy back for America, you bet you got to fight another fight. Welcome back. Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. And it's time for our Republican Family Values Alert. Whoa, wait a second. There we go. Time for our Republican Family Values Alert. Yes, indeed. You will recall the other day that we... where'd it go here? We had the wonderful Mr. Neil Horsey, the anti-abortion Republican activist, talking with Alan Colmes.
Do you like sex with animals?
Oh, when you grow up on a farm in Georgia, and your first girlfriend is a mule.
I'm not so sure that is so.
Well, that's because you didn't grow up on a farm in Georgia. Did you?
Are you suggesting that everybody who grows up on a farm in Georgia has a mule as a girlfriend?
I'm saying that it has historically been the case. You people are so far removed from...
Yeah, you people, you're so far... You liberals, you're so far removed from what's going on in the real world. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So, Republican Family Values. And then yesterday we discovered that the FDA doc, who is leading the charge to make the morning after pill illegal, who's been keeping it off the market, had been raping his wife, on the wrong side. And now the latest Republican Family Values alert for the day.
Yeah, spreading out so far and wide. Keep Manhattan, just give me that countryside.
Now, the latest Republican Family Values, a county Republican in Florida says his bid to head the state party was sabotaged because a letter falsely accused him of having been married 6 times. The right number, he says, is 5. That's unconscionable. Seminole County Republican Party Chairman Jim Stelling said Tuesday in a trial over his defamation suit, he said, "I believe in family values." Yes.
I swear.
You are
yes.
My wife.
Goodbye,
city. Oh, my. Nancy Getman, a former county GOP executive committee, sent out a letter to party executives statewide before the 2003 election for chairman of the Republican Party of Florida, pointing out that this guy had 6 wives. He says... he's suing her for defamation because he says he only had 5 wives. Her letter, he says, falsely implied he did not have high moral standards. Getman, acting as her own attorney, said Stelling, she says, 5 wives or 6, when the number gets that high, does being off by 1 really matter? Who knows? Oh, well, I hope you have a wonderful weekend, my friends. Happy Friday. Shabbat Shalom. TGIF, Friday the 13th. Enjoy your weekend. I'm same place. Tom Hartman, FM. Thanks to Louise for producing the program. And thanks to you for listening. See you next week.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.